And it's Steve Tasker who has been all over the field.
Kind of unique. He was kind of a dual role player for you.
Steve.
I'm a loony.
Steve. A blimp? We're not even in the stratosphere of normalcy.
All right, here we go. Revving it up on a Friday. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you. The OBL Friday fan mailbag is open for you to send in any question you might have about the Bills or the NFL at large. Or you can call us and ask your question right there at 803-0550, 1-888-550-2550. As we sit on the precipice of Super Bowl 56.
The precipice.
Yeah. I like that word. It's a fun word to say.
It's a good word.
Yeah, so it'll be good. Looking forward to it.
Are you?
So I'm expecting a competitive game.
Yeah, me too.
Please, unless, no blowouts.
The only way I see this getting out of hand is if LA's pass rush with Von Miller and Aaron Donald and those guys go bonkers over the top of Quentin Spain and then whoever else the offensive line is of the Bengals, then it's going to get out of hand. That's the only way I see it. I think it's going to be a good game. Joe Burrow seems to be the real thing. He'll be able to keep him in it. And Matt Stafford always seems to have that one, like, what are you doing, kind of throw.
Could have a goofy play.
Could have a goofy play to keep it close or whatever. So I think it's going to be a good game. I was going to ask you, you and I could be construed as having jobs in the football world.
Yeah.
Are you going to do anything special for the game?
The only thing I do every year is make my chili. So that will be happening.
So you have to start like today? Is it like a 2 day? Is it
I've got everything I need already. So it will begin in earnest Sunday, probably after church.
Right.
Get home from church. It's midday. You're still about 6 hours away from kickoff. And I have to transport the chili.
Going
to my brother-in-law's house.
Yeah, okay.
So it's got to be transported. In crock
pot. You know, the meme that's coming is the one from The Office where the guy spills the 50-gallon bucket.
Yeah, I'm not doing that.
Yeah,
I put too much
that.
Into my chili to be careless in transport.
Yeah, I'm a big – how big a vat do you have, like a 12-quart?
Here's the thing, and it's fortunate for me and for my son, quite frankly. We're really the only primary chili consumers.
Right.
My brother-in-law will have some. My father-in-law will have some. I don't know what it is.
Like a bowl piece.
I don't know what it is about the female side of my wife's family. They don't eat chili. My daughter won't. She won't.
Like, won't eat it?
They don't. It's not their thing. Which, isn't horrible. It's more for us. It's not terrible.
It's good food. Don't eat it.
On the whole, they don't really eat it. So because of that, I usually only make it with 2 pounds of chopped meat. And that's enough. It's more than enough. I usually have plenty left over, which is great because then I bring it into work for lunch Monday, Tuesday.
Yeah, I get
beautiful
it.
Thing.
You
have a big family, though. I imagine you got to make giant.
We're empty nesters. So
well, I know, but who comes? People are coming over.
Right. So what we do is I'll make the most of it, and then she'll say, hey, take some home for the, give them a big, side part.
The Tupperware assembly line, yeah.
For me, what about this? I'm a big one for making so much you can freeze it and then pop it out later. It's like wine. The more you freeze it, unfreeze it, and put it through, treat it like.
There are three things.
Badly after you make it, it's better later on down
the line. There are three things in the general lexicon of food that you can freeze or consume leftover, and you can make the argument it's better than when it was fresh.
See, all right. Okay? This is, all right.
Here are the three things I will submit to the list.
I smell something coming here.
Three things I will submit to the list. Chili is one.
Chili.
So I'll give you your chili. Chinese food leftover. Not frozen. I'm saying leftover food. Okay?
Okay.
So if you've ever had Chinese food a day later, warmed up in the microwave, on a regular plate, not the aluminum tin
they serve it in.
Can't put that in the microwave. You could make the genuine argument.
Okay.
It tastes better than it did fresh.
I'll listen to that. What's the third one?
I think there are... Well, this depends on how picky you are as an eater. But I think, and this is not a frozen conversation either, leftover.
Right. This is refrigerated.
Yeah. I believe leftover pizza can be very good.
I kind of knew that was coming.
Those would be my three.
Reheat. And I'll say this. I'll give you the pizza,
I genuinely prefer to reheat it and not in a microwave. Do not reheat pizza in a microwave for
me. Yeah,
you
need
ever.
To go in the oven.
Put it in the oven on a little sheet of aluminum foil. Mm-hmm. Gets it nice and crispy again.
Yeah, if you're
going to
reheat
it,
so it does.
But you could do pizza cold, too.
It expands the menu of what you can do if you're going to reheat it. There's a lot of stuff that, yeah. Chili, for me, is the number one overall pick on food that has been left over or frozen and then revived.
My wife, very often, because, well, she makes her own sauce, but if she's making, like, a lasagna, she'll make two batches.
Right, freeze one, yeah.
Sauce for two batches. And so she'll make a tray of lasagna for now, Sunday, and then she'll freeze another one. And I would argue that the only pasta that you can really freeze, reheat, and it's just as good is lasagna. When you start getting into the smaller pastas and you freeze them and bring it back out, it gets a little soggy.
You couldn't tell a lasagna that was frozen and heated as the one that was made fresh. It's the same. To me, it's the same.
Yeah, and I think it's because you got a lot of, you know, you got big noodles, surface area.
It's packed in there.
It's packed in tight. Not a lot of moisture to kind of sog your pasta.
See, I grew up right in the heart of the country, right in the middle in Kansas, and you can't take your jacket off without elbowing a cow.
Right. So it's a meat and potato state.
Well, it's a grain growing state.
Yeah.
They grow more wheat than any state in the country.
Yeah.
And so because of that, there's a lot of cattle out there because the cattle are there, the food is there, feed it to the cows, you got meat, and then they ship fresh meat everywhere. Like it's a big steel industry it's big.
So by age six, you pretty much knew every cut of meat that could come off a cow. Like
flank
when
steak,
I was sick, I did not
steak,
know what a ribeye was.
Beef, prime rib, yes.
Porterhouse, like
porterhouse,
you knew all
the cuts T-bone.
By age six,
yes,
probably.
Absolutely.
They quiz you on it in first grade.
You knew that it started with beef and went from there. Now, I will say this. Also, it's also pork is out there as well.
Oh,
okay. They've started. So, yeah, and that's why I told you, when you go down the list of things that the proteins that you eat, it starts at the top with me, probably with pork now.
These are your favorite meats you're giving us
Yes.
now.
Yes, it goes pork, beef, probably, then I would say probably, sheep?
Oh, lamb.
Lamb.
Yeah.
Then it would go down through. I'm trying to think. I'm missing some. Chicken is there somewhere, but that's down below probably. What else is there? You know, I'm not going to go into wild meat, wild game or anything, but it would be beef. It would be pork, beef, sheep.
Really? Lamb's third. Okay.
Yeah. Have you ever had lamb? You go to a lamb place, into a restaurant, go, you cannot beat it. It's like candy.
Yeah,
it's really good, but
there is a very small cooking window in preparing that the right way.
Well, here's the thing:
you
too.
Go over a couple of minutes.
For me,
it's not the same.
It's like leg of lamb chops, and there's nothing else. I mean, you can't go into all the different kinds of beef you can make, and like bacon, and
it's limited.
Yeah, right. All that stuff. So
the pig is the most versatile.
The pig is the one. That's the one where you give me that. Then beef, and I love beef. And then lamb, but then you get into the birds, and at the bottom is scale fish.
Wow, fish at the bottom. Okay.
Yeah, you got to go all the way through. You got to go all the way through. And that's
coming from a landlocked
chicken.
State.
And
I should not be surprised.
Listen, I'll say this. Below the scaled fish would be turkey for me. Because I put clams, mussels, shellfish, crustaceans, scaled fish, turkey.
I got to say, your preferences are, they're a show unto itself. It's just so entertaining. I think I would still put beef ahead of pork. Beef ahead of pork for me because, and I'm probably a...
Well, I eat way more
beef. I am probably a man of simple pleasures on the food spectrum. I'm not afraid to experiment or go outside the box and try things. But if you're giving me like a last meal, you know, and it has to involve one of said meats that you listed, I'm just having a big old sloppy burger, man. I'm just having a big sloppy burger.
I eat more burgers than probably
any beef
human.
Is probably at the top of my list for that reason.
Yeah, I'll eat more cheeseburgers per week than most
and
Americans.
I would get brisket over barbecue pork any day of the week.
I will say that as well. Brisket
again, I turn to beef first.
Brisket and bacon. Well, the brisket kind of – you got to – brisket.
It's beef brisket.
You got to have spices on it, right?
True.
Bacon. I mean, there is candy maple bacon and all that, and that's good. But bacon is just bacon. Fine. Right? So
– who had the over-under
bacon
on
bacon and brisket. Bacon and brisket are the candy of, you know
– right.
Right? So, yeah. That's the best. And I'll say this.
But I think beef first for me.
And it's rare for me that you can go down a list and I can go say, hey, we had a restaurant here but there's a place in Tampa called Burn Steakhouse. You go in there and their go-to dish, their wings that they have, you know, like buffalo wings, is a thing called Chateaubriand.
Really?
And you can get it all the way up to like 64 ounces of this thing, right?
Good
Lord.
It's
huge. It's a tenderloin. I guess it's a tenderloin. I don't know what kind of beef
that's
it is.
4 pounds of meat.
But you can get it as small or as big as you want, and it's Chateaubriand for two is the thing. You get it going with a date, and you get it. And you could cut that thing with a
butter
knife.
Yeah.
With a fork. And it's just – so that's
– So if beef could fall off the bone, that would be it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But even so, that beef, pork is still right up there.
When we went over to London for the Bills-Jacksonville game in 2015,
right?
I had a very difficult time
with
finding
food.
Good food.
Right, it's different.
England struggles. They really do.
Yeah.
So I went to an establishment, not going to remember the name. I asked for a hamburger. It was like a hockey puck.
Oh.
It was terrible.
Yeah.
I asked them, do you have any pickles? Because I like pickle chips on my burgers generally.
Right.
The guy looked at me like I had three heads. Whatever do you mean, sir? I'm like, you know, pickles. Sliced pickle chips. Like you put them on a hamburger. The guy had no concept of what I was talking about. He goes, let me see what I can find for you. He comes back. With pickled relish. That was the best they could do.
Well,
I got to tell you right
world,
now,
man.
I had a whole new respect for U.S. beef after that trip.
Oh, yeah.
Because what they got over there,
well, it's because
there's
don't
no
have
reason
the,
anyone should be overweight in
well,
England.
They live on
the
an
food
island.
Is that bad.
To begin with, they live on an island.
No one should be overweight in that country, though. The food is awful.
Well, yeah.
It's awful.
Yeah.
Like, it's terrible. I mean, in terms of native food. You know, you got after fish and chips, the list is pretty short over there. It's terrible.
Yeah. We went to Ireland a few years ago, spent 8 days there. I must have had fish and chips like 10 times.
That's the way to go.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Then
what
you
else
get that right.
You know, if somebody makes a good bangers and mash, you know,
yeah,
that's okay.
I'm with you.
But man, the list is short over there. It is short.
I remember that. Yeah, you can't miss with pork though. And here's the thing. So I was at Bruce Smith's golf tournament, and it was one of these big things. Two golf courses, like six gazillion people there, food everywhere, right?
Yeah.
So I'm sitting there, and just because I remember it this way, Marino's there, Dan, and Marino, we're friends.
Yeah.
This is years ago, and we're gonna. You know, there's all these people around, so we're going to try to sneak away. We're going to go out and play a few golf holes, just the two of us.
Oh, just while everybody's eating.
Right, everybody's eating and kind of gathering up. You know, so we got time. So we go out and we play a couple of holes, and you know, there's a big party the night before, and we're kind of hungry, right? So we're hanging a little bit. So so we're looking around. There's this guy over there on one of these holes. He's got this smoker that's the size, I swear, it's a trailer. It's the size of this studio, right? I mean, it's huge,
wow.
Right? He's got this smoker that looks like you could live in it, right? And we go over, and he goes, hey, you got any food? I mean, and the guy's like, sees Dan. He's like, oh, yeah, I might have something. So he, like, you know, it's like one of those things he like buckles the door and the side of the thing folds up, you know, like a garage door,
only
smaller. Like,
kind of like an accordion a little bit?
And inside this thing is this big, like, it's bigger than a 4x8 sheet of plywood, right?
So it's a rack of
That's how big the grill is.
Yeah.
And there's one pig in it.
Oh, a whole pig.
Well, it's a whole pig in two pieces.
Okay.
Split
down the middle.
Split down the middle, like with a band. I don't know how they did it. So that it's like laying there. It's a pig. And I don't know what to do. I'm like, what are we, you know, he goes, all right, I got you. And so he goes over and gets in a bag, like a plastic bag, pulls out two big buns, like hands Dan one, hands me, all right, so we're standing there with these buns. Like,
he goes over,
he grabs these two big gloves, puts these
up
like
to his
rubber, like utility electrician's gloves on, reaches in and just like puts his hand into the pig.
Pulls out a hunk.
And like slops it on like snow, like a snowball. Like, here's one for you.
So it was that tender already. It'd been cooking all day.
No, you've been like since yesterday. It's been for like 18 hours. So Dan and I, like, okay, like that. No, like no sauce,
nothing
on it, right? And so we, thanks. So we take off and we go get on our car. We're going to play some golf. So we start eating these because we're like, you think I'm with a burrito. This pork sandwich was like, we were
inhaling
it. So we like inhale these two sandwiches before we can even drive to the next. And they're huge. So they're gone. And we sit there, we tee off on the next hole.
I just love how that's randomly some guy on the course.
Bruce, it's a big tournament. So Bruce brought on all these places. Yeah. You know, there's all this food. So we're driving down to hit these. We tee off. We're going down to hit. And I'm looking at Moreno. He goes, he looked at me and he goes, that was the greatest sandwich I have ever eaten. I go, I know. It was so good. He goes, let's go get another one.
U-turn.
So we just did a U-turn, left our golf balls, went back, got another sandwich, then went on and played golf.
That's fantastic.
So pork is big on my menu.
All right. Well, we have some people that want to weigh in on this, believe it or not. We got to go to Larry in Portageville. What do you have for us, Larry?
It's on pizza. It's got to be one of the ones that you can eat over and over again. But I don't refrigerate it.
You just leave it out?
Leave it out. Yeah, leave it out.
Yeah, it's good.
Lasagna and chili.
Yeah,
lasagna, well, yeah.
Yeah, I make my chili with a venison burger.
Ooh, venison. Yeah. Okay. See, I've had some of those.
See, that's the thing. So many people have never tried wild game, like elk, moose, bison, if you call bison a wild game, mountain sheep, deer, of course.
Venison's very lean, and when you're cooking with
wild
a lean
really
meat,
lean.
It's not always as flavorful in something like a chili because there's no fat in it, and the fat is what kind of gives the flavor, the bone, like if you have a bone in on something.
My friend, who is a director for CBS, Mark Grant, he's a Louisiana guy.
Oh.
And he came up to the house. I had all the CBS guys when we were doing games. We had him to the house, and he made gumbo.
Oh.
And so all he says was, yeah, you got to do this and da-da-da. He goes, that's the thing. When you cook stuff, the people in New Orleans say, no salt, no fat, no taste.
Yeah.
So it's got to be fat and salty, and then it's good. It can be good. So, yeah. But
when making gumbo.
The wild game is hard to do.
And when making gumbo, the shrimp always goes in last.
Oh, there you go.
Always last. Mike in Jamestown has a comment on game. What do you have, Mike?
I was just going to ask Steve, growing up in Kansas, did you eat much venison?
No.
I eat a lot of it growing up in Western New York.
No. There's less, thing, and a lot of old guys here, and I say old guys, a lot of old guys like me, even older than me, will tell you, in Kansas, yes, there's a lot of deer, but there's not many hunters out there. What the thing is they hunt is ringneck pheasant.
Oh.
You grow up hunting ringneck pheasant. They used to do that a lot here in Western New York until I think they got one or two bad winters and it decimated the population.
Yeah.
But ringneck pheasant is a big thing out there. That's still, even today, is a cottage industry out there.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Yeah, I remember used to seeing a lot of pheasants growing up on Long Island, but I don't know if they're around much anymore.
Yeah, I think the climate change got them.
Yeah. One more. We go to Craig in East Aurora. What do you have for us, Craig?
Well, you guys were talking about Chateaubriand.
Oh, yeah.
That is the best cut. It's the center cut of the tenderloins from before the tail. And right before the head. And that is the best thing to do. Steve was talking about that.
Yeah. They take it out, and when they give it to you, you can tell, I don't know where there's some, I don't know where they got, I guess a butcher, but some it's surgically removed. I mean, it's just one long muscle.
Yeah.
The
strip is.
The fibers go all from length, the length of it, and they just set it. And it's so unbelievable. Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Craig. Sorry, appreciate Craig. That call.
Yeah. Wow. Who knew that? We've got four people chiming in on the food conversation. We do have a lot of news and notes to get to, so we better get to that now, as we have a lot of ground to cover. In the wake of last night's NFL honors, which is essentially the Oscars for the NFL, run down the awards quickly here. Rookie of the Year, Ja'Marr Chase from the Bengals. Defensive Player of the Year, T.J. Watt. That was no surprise. Best Moment of the Year, Justin Tucker's record-breaking 66-yard field goal. I thought that was a good choice. AP Offensive Rookie of the Year, Ja'Marr Chase. AP Offensive Player of the Year, Cooper Kupp. Defensive Rookie of the Year, Micah Parsons. Art Rooney Sportsmanship Award goes to Matthew Slater, who I know you know very well, Patriots special teamer. AP Comeback Player of the Year, Joe Burrow, coming back from the ACL last year. AP Assistant Coach of the Year, Dan Quinn, the DC of the Dallas Cowboys. Unstoppable Performance of the Year, Joe Burrow against the Chiefs in Week 17. What'd they come back from, 21 down or something, or 17 down?
24-3 or 21-3, something like that.
It was something like that. Deacon Jones Sack Leader Award, obviously T.J. Watt, FedEx Air Ground and Players of the Year, Tom Brady and Jonathan Taylor. Celebration of the Year, Miami Dolphins defensive lineman Christian Wilkins when he did the worm after scoring in the end zone. Yeah. He did the little breakdance move. Coach of the Year, Mike Vrabel from Tennessee. Fantasy Player of the Year, Cooper Kupp. Most Valuable Player, Aaron Rodgers. Walter Payton Man of the Year, Andrew Whitworth. Longtime offensive tackle in the league for both the Bengals and the Rams.
Yeah.
And he unfortunately suffered a season-ending injury. He's not playing. So
Andrew Whitworth told a fantastic story when he accepted the award about he was with the Rams this year, obviously playing, and it was like week seven. And I can't now I'm going to forget the guy's name. But they finished the game, and this player on the Detroit Lions ran towards him and was looking like beeline for him. And he's like, oh, no,
seen the guy looking at him all through pregame, just like staring at him uncomfortably.
Right, so it's weird. So the guy came in and goes, what is it? And the guy was
– he's a rookie.
He's a rookie, and he
said,
listen,
Lions.
When you were with Cincinnati, you did a lot of work with the Boys and Girls Clubs, and you took a lot of time and spent with me. And you told me about life, and we spent a lot of time together, and I just want to let you know I made it. You know?
Yeah.
That's pretty touching.
Yeah, I mean, Whitworth had played, I think this was his 18th season.
Right.
And unfortunately, it didn't finish well for him. He had an injury. But yeah, this kid was a 22-year-old rookie who 18 years ago was like 4 or 5, you know? So early in his career, Andrew was doing a lot of community work in Cincinnati, YMCAs, Boys and Girls Clubs, pouring into young kids. And this young kid was one of the guys, and our MSG viewers are seeing it now. He came up to him after the game and thanked him. He thanked him.
Yeah, he said, I made it to the NFL, Big Wit. And that it's stuff like that that's it's more than just a great story. I mean, it's guys like Andrew Whitworth, the guys like Harrison Phillips and others, you know, Josh
Emmanuel
Allen,
Sanders.
Emmanuel Sanders and Steph Diggs, and even guys, you know, guys down the roster. You have a chance to affect people, and this Walter Payton Man of the Year award is testament to that and
it's
what these
great
guys
when,
can do.
It's great when players recognize the power of the platform that they have and use it in ways like this. That's the great thing. And I'll throw in a little Bills tie here. Andrew Whitworth was Kyle Williams' college roommate. They are very good friends. Played at LSU together in college.
Imagine those two.
Yeah, right?
That's a couple of
Andrew Whitworth and Kyle Williams.
That's a couple of picture that dorm room where the
not
two
a lot
beds
of space left.
And the two beds that are creaking and groaning over those two. You see the? Can you imagine if it was the two beds? They had to replace the beds after those guys lived
yeah.
there.
Aaron Rodgers winning back-to-back MVPs becomes just the second player in NFL history to win four MVPs. The other is Tom Brady, who has won five. And Rodgers was interviewed by NFL Network, and he said, well, I've got some decisions to make for sure. Yesterday was the first day that kind of felt like the offseason. I had a couple of things I had to do before I got back to the West Coast, and then I actually was out and blah, blah, blah. He's talking about where he's been. He said, so I'm going to enjoy the next couple of weeks. I've had good conversations with Green Bay. I'll do some contemplating and make a decision here pretty quick. Now, we know that Rodgers' stats are off the charts. I don't know if I've seen a better thrower in the history of the league in terms of accuracy. Not saying best quarterback, best pure thrower in terms of accuracy and putting it on people. I don't know if I've seen better. Now, here's the thing that impressed me the most of all his statistics, okay? Rodgers, again this year, was phenomenal when he needed to lead the Packers to comeback wins. He finished first in the league in completion percentage, passing yards per attempt, touchdown to interception ratio, and passer rating when his team was behind this year. His completion percentage when his team's behind on the scoreboard, 71.8. Passing yards per attempt when his team is behind on the scoreboard, 9.2. Touchdown to interception ratio, 14-2. Passer rating, 126. Now, here's the best part of it. His 37-4 touchdown to interception ratio was the third highest in a single season in NFL history and one of the six highest marks all time. Touchdown to interception ratio. Third highest in a single season ever, one of the six highest of all time. He has all six of them.
Yeah.
All six of the touchdown to interception ratio lead. He's got the top six ratios in league history.
Yeah, that's why he's elite. That's why.
That's insane.
Why even that's why playing in Green Bay, that's why he is consistently got his team to like 13 wins, 11 wins, 12 wins, you know, and gets them deep in the playoffs every year. It's interesting that that's not enough for that Green Bay Packers to win another Super Bowl.
That's extraordinary, though.
It almost looks like a statistical anomaly.
Yeah.
And yet, you think about it, it's over the course of 16 years.
And unfortunately, the only thing I would possibly compare it to would be the Drew Brees stat with 5,000-yard passing seasons. I think he had seven of the nine before the league went to 17 games. And I think, unfortunately, with the league going to 17 games and probably 18 games in the not-too-distant future, that record will lose its impressiveness.
Right.
But that would be the only thing that I think you could put on a par with this. Touchdown to interception ratio, he has the six highest marks of all time. He has all six of them.
Yeah.
That's nuts.
Yeah.
When you think about the quarterbacks that have played, like Peyton Manning, Tom Brady, they're not even up there. He's got all six of them.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Good for him.
I know he's only got one Super Bowl ring to show for it, but he's going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer. We know this, but God.
And we always have this thing, particularly if anybody who spends time on football social media, they got this big slogan that it's almost a slogan now. It's like, wins are not a QB stat. And because when people talk about quarterbacks, they always bring up, he hadn't won this many games, hasn't won that many. Like Matt Stafford in Detroit, he didn't win many games. And are wins a QB stat or not? And Stafford, you put together a fantastic career on a team that never won many games. So Rodgers' career, the fact that he started, it took him 3 years to actually get on the field because of the presence of Brett Favre and all of that. And then once he did, he has taken the league. He has been one of the top one or two with Tom Brady. He's played at the same time as Tom Brady and has won four MVPs. He's just been off the charts good. And the thing about it, too, is that consistency. every single year. They don't get – it's a big thing. They don't – they've never drafted a receiver number one. He's doing it with guys who are – everybody else had a chance to pick and wouldn't. You know, and they're not – now, these guys aren't cast-offs, but certainly they never got a massively touted college wide receiver or running back, for that matter, for the Green Bay Packers.
Yeah.
He's done it with other people, and obviously he's done it very well.
Unbelievable. Speaking of Packers, we're going to talk to a former Super Bowl winning Green Bay Packer by the name of Aaron Taylor, their former offensive lineman, will be joining us in hour number two, about a half hour from now. And he is a draft analyst for CBS Sports, former Packers first round pick back in 94, and was part of their Super Bowl 31 winning team, the team with Brett Favre that beat the Patriots. He's also got a couple of good stories, including one on your good friend Don Beebe, who obviously went to, what was that, his fifth or was it his sixth Super Bowl, Beebs? That
was his fifth? Fifth, and they
and
went
then
to
they
the
won.
Next one as well.
Yeah, so they won the fifth one. He went
won
to
the
six
fifth
altogether.
One. He was 1-5 in Super Bowls.
Yeah.
One of, I think, a handful of people up to that point, where now there's some Patriot guys who obviously have been to a bunch, but Tom Brady, one of them. But Beebs was one of two people who had been to six Super Bowls, and they were both members of our team for the four Super Bowls in Buffalo.
Right.
Mike Lodish, who went to two with Denver.
Broncos, right.
And Don Beebe, who went to two with the Packers after the subsequent Buffalo Bill years.
And he'll also be talking to us about mental health in sports, so a good message there from him as well. We look forward to that. Final half hour of the show, we'll also have the latest installment of Tasker's Teammates, so you want to stay tuned for that as well. We will take a break here, but when we come back, we heard from a few Bills through the course of the NFL Honors programs and on Radio Row at the Super Bowl. We will bring you up to speed on what was said. And Josh Allen was a part of that NFL Honors show last night. We'll let you know how he did next here on One Bills Live, presented by Collider Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, welcome back to One Bills Live. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you here on a Friday before Super Bowl 56. As we mentioned, NFL Honors Show was on last night. It's basically the Oscars for the NFL. And Josh Allen was incorporated into the evening's festivities by host Keegan-Michael Key, the comedian who's often paired, you know, people know him from Key and Peele and the funny skits those guys do as comedians. But he was hosting the show last night, and he was commenting on how much fun everyone was having through the course of the evening. And he plopped himself down next to Josh Allen, and this happened.
This is so much fun. A show like this, you just want it to go on and on and on and on and on. Am I right, Josh Allen?
Or you just end it in a way that makes sense, is fair, and gives everyone an equal opportunity to win.
He carried it off, man. He did a great, nice job.
Had a nice pregnant pause with the or. Line delivery was excellent there. So good on Josh for playing along with the NFL Honors Show. He is obviously referring to the lack of an opportunity for Buffalo's offense to get on the field in overtime in the divisional playoff against Kansas City.
I told you my family had an event this last weekend, and we were back in Kansas where I grew up and my family still lives and all that. So obviously it's big-time Chiefs country. Yeah. I could not tell you how many Chiefs fans felt exactly the same way. It's like, oh, because nobody wanted the game to end.
Yeah.
Right. And they said, they were saying that's why we want to change the rules so that doesn't happen. Because the Chiefs and the Bills fans are still smarting over losing the coin toss and stuff. The Chiefs went through the exact same thing 3 years before this with the Patriots.
Right.
Doing the exact same
They've been on both sides.
They've been on both sides now of winning the coin toss and losing the coin toss in overtime and having your game go the way the coin toss did, so just like the Bills did. So all the Chiefs fans, when I went back this last weekend, they were kind of the same real. Of course, they were all positive and happy, but they were all like, wow, they could really commiserate with the Bills fans and thought, they were nothing but respectful. And it's awesome to see how that what they thought the exact same thing that Bills fans thought about that game and how it went.
Stephon Diggs was making the rounds at Radio Row as well out in L.A., and he appeared on the Man to Man podcast with Darius Butler and Antoine Bethea, and he was asked about the importance of being an unselfish player. Both Butler and Bethea were pointing to his stat line in the divisional playoff against the Chiefs, which was 3 receptions for 7 yards. Obviously, Gabriel Davis was going off because for much of the game, Diggs was getting bracketed, by the corner and the safety. And, you know, they were double teaming him. But that what that was doing, actually, Steve, was it was pulling a safety out of the middle of the field. And it's part of the reason Gabe Davis went off. Here is Diggs' take on being wide receiver number one and not being the focal point of the offense in the divisional playoff. I thought his answer was very team-oriented. Here's Stephon.
Like, I even talked about it with the media. I'm like, listen, I'm trying not to live in that realm of, all right, I want a revenge. Like, I want XYZ for myself. Because when you get in the playoffs, it ain't about you. You know what I'm saying? The regular season accolades, Pro Bowl, all that, that's some regular season. Like, when you get in the playoffs, it come down to winning. And, of course, like, as a dog, y'all know me. So, like, of course I want 100 catches. Of course I want to be targeted every play. Of course I want to make that impact. But for that game, I couldn't go to my quarterback and demand the ball. I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
He was playing a hell of a game.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Gabe Davis had 4 touchdowns. We was in the playoffs, and we scoring 36 points.
Yeah.
I don't give a who having a – who's scoring? Who getting the credit?
Yeah.
It's all about who eating. Because me, I don't shy away from being confident.
Yeah.
People know me. They know what I could do. You know what I'm saying? When you have games like that, I had 3 catches for 7 yards. I'm like, yeah, I wish I would have had a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? But having a lot more at the expense of losing, that's selfish.
Yeah.
If I say I'm a winner, like I say I am,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to be willing to take the top off and clear it out for an in cut. I'm going to be willing to get doubled in the red zone so the middle of the field wide open. You got a single safety or you man to man. That's what you kind of got to bite. And I got big enough shoulders to carry the weight of saying I'll sacrifice for my team to win. You see what I'm saying? Because I mean, at the end of the day, I still feel like I know I'm nice. I know what I can do. I'm getting open on double teams. I'm getting open on single coverage. It's not about me and what I can do personally because personally, I feel like – I'm the guy, so I feel like I'm him, so I ain't really pushing that. But as far as for my team to be pushed into another stratosphere of just push, making that Super Bowl push and doing all that, I got to do my part of getting everybody else open. You know what I'm saying? They going to get open on their own, but if I can attract 2 safeties or do whatever, man, part of that,
trust me, for 2 DBs, it helps.
I want 4 touchdowns. I want a million yards. Yeah. But that game, look, this the game plan. If I get some opportunities, cool. If I don't, listen, I'm trying to win.
It's hard to argue with that. And Steve, I've seen this before from other players around the league when referring to the culture that Sean McDermott has cultivated here. And while there is heavy buy-in here at One Bills Drive from the players top to bottom on the roster, I would argue that it has better staying power here in Buffalo because some of the people that abide by that mantra are some of the best players and leaders on the entire team. It's guys like Diggs and Allen who are leading the charge on this is the way we do things here. Everybody else just falls in line.
The Super Bowl teams I was on, the best players were the hardest workers. And they were unselfish. And, you know, they had a stretch that was unprecedented for that reason. And I've talked to other teams. You know, obviously, I know other players on great teams. You know, Michael Irvin, Emmitt Smith, Troy Aikman, the triplets there. And other teams like, you know, the Jerry Rices and the Steve Youngs, the Brent Joneses of the San Francisco teams. You know, you go down the list of all these great teams, and I've talked to guys who were not Elway himself, but guys who were on Elway's teams there that won 2 Super Bowls at the end of his career. They all say the same thing about how much love and respect there was in the locker room, but they also knew that the guys who made it go, the great ones, were two things. They were hard workers, and they were unselfish. They were for the guys on their team. They were for the success of all of us. The rising ocean lifts all the ships. So if we're successful, everybody gets lifted by it. And that's what the mantra is. And Steph Diggs, I think most Bills fans, particularly the ones locally here who watch the team and read about it every day, and that, not to say that you don't do that out and away and off in other parts of the world, but there was a marked change, a noticeable change, in the at least the perception about Steph Diggs when they made him a team captain at the beginning of this last year.
Yeah.
He welcomed it and felt a great responsibility for it. And being a football captain isn't like being a hockey captain. It's a little different. It's not quite like that.
Yeah.
But there is something there. And he took it extremely seriously, and as well you should, because it's a, not only a vote of confidence and something, but it's also, I think, when they named Steph Diggs a captain, there was a there was an expectation placed on him and he placed on himself. And I think it was illustrated in that soundbite we just saw. He changed himself and became something this year that he hadn't been to this point in his career.
Emmanuel Sanders also made the rounds. He was on NFL Network yesterday. As you know, his contract is up. He is set to become a free agent. And he was asked if he's going to retire. I'm going to read you his response. Quote, Josh was like, let's run it back. Right now, I'm in a position where I'm the oldest receiver in the league, and I have a son who's going to turn 8. I've got some decisions to make on if I still want to continue to play. I'm missing out on my son's games, and I'm moving my family around, so I have a lot of things to consider. Right after the playoff loss against the Chiefs, Josh was telling me, hey, let's run it back. And I was like, man, give me some time to reflect and see how I feel. He mentioned he is the oldest receiver in the entire league. But he said, if I do decide to play, it would be back in Buffalo. I don't know if that's going to happen. As I mentioned, he's 34. I believe he turns 35 before next season. I just marvel at the fact that he has played, I believe it is now 5 NFL seasons since suffering an Achilles injury.
Yeah.
Wide receiver in the NFL at the tail end of his career after an Achilles rupture. I mean, you got my respect, man. I mean, that is, to me, that is rare.
Yeah.
Like, that is a serious, serious injury. And for such a high-impact position with so much running, cutting, stopping, starting, 5 more years in your 30s after an Achilles injury?
Yeah.
Tip my hat, man.
Absolutely. It's an unheard-of recovery. Before Kobe Bryant did it in the NBA, I didn't know it could be done. When I played 25,
that was an ender. That was a career ender in your era.
It was worse than a knee injury. A ruptured Achilles, you're done. The trainers that I played with and for told me that a number of times. They pop Achilles. Yeah, that's it for him. That's no way. They're not coming back from that. But to have him do that, and obviously, you know, they're still working at it, but it takes an enormous amount of commitment to overcome an injury like that and to get back to where you're supposed to be and can be and we can compete. Oh, my gosh. You say that, well, he went through rehab. That doesn't do it justice. It doesn't do it justice. You live, eat, sleep, breathe, and you know, you just, that's all you do. That's all you do until you're back. It's just, it's an unbelievable story to have these guys go through that and to have come back and played well at it. Yeah, and to have him come back and put that many more years behind himself and after that, it's, you're right.
Yeah, and I had the numbers wrong. It was only the last 3 seasons post-Achilles. So age 32, 33, and 34 seasons. Maybe it's more impressive now. Last 3 years of his career played post-Achilles injury. Unbelievable.
It's impressive when you're 12, let alone when you're 32.
Yeah, so we'll see what decision he ultimately makes. It wouldn't shock me, though, if he decides to call it a career here, but stranger things have happened. We have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to take a look at just where the Bengals Who Day chant originated from. It's an interesting story, and you may not be surprised to know it involves beer. That's coming up next here on One Bills Live, presented by Kalata Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. right. Friday on One Bills Live, and Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you. Told you before the break we were going to reveal the origins of the Who Day chant that Bengals fans often use during their home games. Who Day, Who Day, Who Day think going to beat them Bengals, Who Day. And then they all shout, nobody. So the origins of this are tied to beer, Steve. Hudepohl Beer Company has been a staple in Cincinnati's beer industry since 1885.
Okay.
And naturally, as professional teams, you know, the Reds, even the old ABA team, I think it was the Cincinnati Royals, I believe is the name.
I think that's right.
I don't know. I think that's the right name. In any event, because, yeah, I think Oscar Robinson played for them. Anyway, and then the Bengals, coming in the late 60s, they were the beer vendor for all of these professional sports franchises, you know, so the beer's in the stands. And so the beer vendor guys walking around, you know, the concessionaires walking around with the big trays, you know, with the strap around their neck, they would shout, I got Hootie here, Hootie, because it's Hudepohl beer, Hootie. And some people would call it Hoodie, not Hootie, because it's Hudepohl. So when they shortened it, some would say Hootie, some would say Hoodie. And then in 1981, when the team went all the way to the Super Bowl, won their first playoff game in franchise history, the Hoodie chant for beer quickly evolved into Who They Say Going to Beat Them Bengals.
I got you.
And off and running they go. By the time you got to 88, when they went to the Super Bowl again,
it was a thing.
The beer company's making commemorative cans.
Oh, yeah.
And all of that stuff. So that is the origin. It's tied to the beer vendor's name. And I actually took the time, Steve, to look up Hudepohl Beer Company. And yeah, on their homepage, it says, Hudepohl Beer, because you live in Cincinnati. Which is a total play off the Sam Weish line when people were throwing snowballs at a Browns-Bengals game.
Right.
They were throwing snowballs at the Cleveland bench and at players and at coaches.
Right.
And the crowd was warned by the PA announcer, if you keep doing it, the Bengals are going to get penalized. Right. Unsportsmanlike conduct, 15-yard penalties, what have you. The snowballs kept flying. So then Sam Weish asked for a microphone, spoke to the crowd and said, you know how to behave like good citizens. You don't live in Cleveland. You live in Cincinnati.
Right.
So it's so they jumped on that, too. So good on them. I thought that was an interesting story. I never would have guessed how it originated.
I had no idea it was the beer company.
And so as we know, the New Orleans Saints have the Who Dat chant, which apparently is a very common question or phrase that is used in New Orleans. Cincinnati claims they had theirs in 81 and that the Saints fans didn't adopt it as a chant in their stadium until 83. So there is some disagreement there as to who had a chant before the other.
And I hear you saying these 81 for the Bengals, you know, and that thing when they went their first Super Bowl, and then 83, just like 40 years ago.
I know.
I forget how old we are,
It's been a minute.
Oof.
It's been a minute.
Wow.
But I thought that was a fun story. I had not known, so I figured maybe our listeners might want to know.
I do remember that. I do remember it was happening in the 88 when we went to Cincinnati for the AFC Championship game.
Yeah.
They were saying that was a thing then, and it had, I thought it was right then, around then when it started, but I guess it was the first Super Bowl, which was, you know, 7 years before that. Yeah. So yeah.
We have to take a break here because when we come back, we will be joined by Packers former first-round draft choice Aaron Taylor, who won a Super Bowl on the Brett Favre team in 96. He's a draft analyst for CBS Sports, and he's also going to be telling us a few of his Super Bowl stories, one which may include one Don Beebe. He's also going to tell us a little bit about why mental health in sports is just as important as physical health. Aaron Taylor, coming your way next here on One Bills Live, presented by Collider Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio.
Faster, touchdown, Buffalo! That's Steve Tasker, who has been all over the field.
Kind of unique. He was kind of a dual role player for you.
Steve.
A balloon.
Steve. A blimp. We're not even in the stratosphere of normalcy. All right, hour number two here on a Friday. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you. And pleased to be joined now by former Packers and Chargers offensive lineman, former first-round pick of the Packers at our Notre Dame back in 94, and Super Bowl 31 champion with the Packers, is current NFL and draft analyst for CBS Sports, Aaron Taylor, joining us on the show. Aaron, good to have you. Once I read that off, I was like, holy cow, the Bills had a first-round pick out of Notre Dame in 94. It was Jeff Burris. So you guys were both first-rounders that year.
Yeah, I was just talking with Jeff today, as a matter of fact, man. We all look back at that time in our lives, and we were so wide-eyed and bushy-tailed and optimistic about what was going to go down. And he went to Buffalo, and I went to Green Bay, and Bryant Young, who just went into the Hall of Fame last night, went out to San Francisco. So we all been kind of reminiscing, but Buffalo still holds a big place in Jeff Burris' heart, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, he was a teammate of mine as well. You also had a guy play with you as a teammate in Don Beebe. You guys won the Super Bowl together, So, yeah, it's a small world when you get up and start playing in the NFL and spend any time around it. You start rubbing up against a lot of people you have mutual friends with. What's going on? Give us a sense of the vibe in L.A. I know it's been a long time since the Super Bowl's been out there. You've been up there. I know you live out there. Give us a sense of how it's being received by the city.
The city's loved it, right? They've largely cleaned up the downtown area, which is good in some respects and not so good in others, and to stay away from the density of what's taking place down there. It feels safe, it feels fun, it feels festive, and it's starting to build. We're still at the very tail end of the coronavirus pandemic, as it seems. So I think what we saw 2 years ago in Miami, there were about 300 tables at Radio Row. None last year, obviously. This year, there's about 120, 130. So people are starting to feel comfortable to come back. The parties have been good. It's been great to bump up with old friends. But you know, Steve, better than anybody, that as the week progresses, there's this building anticipation that goes on. And we're in the city of bright lights. The Rams have a ton of star players. So I think it lends itself well for a city and an area of the country that has been starved for Super Bowl action for quite some time.
You got two very young head coaches in this matchup. I think it's the youngest head coaching duo facing one another in a Super Bowl ever, in Sean McVay and Zach Taylor, who actually worked together as well. I know McVay has been there before. You had Mike Holmgren, right, as head coach in Green Bay. He had been there before several times with the 49ers as an assistant. Do you remember what his overriding message was, like, about Super Bowl week, so as not to make too much of the whole pomp and circumstance and just go out and play the game?
That was kind of the general understanding, but I think the nuances of that and how to execute that was really where I think his experience lent itself. But the very first thing that Holmgren did to make sure that we understood what we were about to walk into was have Jim McMahon and Don Beebe get up. Task was talking about me being a former teammate of Beebe's. Those were the only two dudes as players that were on our roster that had any experience. And they both got up and said the exact same thing. And that was, boys, buckle your junk. You about to go through 2 weeks of an experience that you have never seen or even thought about going through. So I was given interviews to Japanese reporters with translators. MTV was there. That one girl, Kat, who I had a low-key crush on, interviewed me, and I was all smitten. There were so many different distractions. Yeah. Family needing hotel rooms, tickets. Who do we sell our tickets to? I hope we're past the statute of limitations on that, by the way. But there were so many different off-the-field ancillary things that were going on that the guy's message was simple. Make first things first and make what's most important. That is extremely hard to do with so many shiny objects and distractions that are attracted to the Super Bowl.
I've always said as well, when you get to Super Bowl week, the media crush is so huge. And you're right, because then now it starts to leak over, not just leak over, but pour over into the entertainment world, where other entities want a piece of what's going on with the NFL. And for most guys, you get it. Football players are creatures of habit and routine. every week is like every other week. And to get to the Super Bowl, so you allot your budget of time and attention and energy to different things. And by, what, Tuesday or Wednesday of Super Bowl week, your budgeted allotment for distractions and media and all that is used up on Tuesday or Wednesday. And so now you got 4 days or 5 days left to get to the game, and you're kind of spent.
It's a challenge, man. It's a bugger. And think about this. Like, when we were little kids in our backyards, all of us that have been blessed enough to play in this game at the highest level, you were thinking about making the kick or the special team play or the throw or the block or the tackle in the big game to win it all. Well, this, for almost everybody except 11 players, 10 on the Rams side and one on Cincinnati side, this is going to be that game. This is their moment. These players will remember what happens on Sunday afternoon and evening for the rest of their lives, right or wrong. And Steve, you know better than anybody how a sour taste in your mouth and not having Super Bowls go the way you want is a lifetime of plague that tends to follow over you. One of my greatest regrets in life as a person was that Green Bay wasn't able to beat Denver in San Diego in Super Bowl 32. We were a better team than them. We knew it, but we didn't execute. We got out-coached, we got outplayed, and we're all going to have to live with that forever. But this distraction thing, this is the second time in NFL history we've seen a team in the Super Bowl playing in the host city. We saw it last year with Tampa, and it worked out. I'm going to suggest this. I think the Rams playing at home this year in LA because of the makeup of the city is actually a distraction. I believe it's a disadvantage because these guys have had their friends, their family, all their entertainment buddies that have been looking for things in this city. So now you have a situation with people that have problems with their hotel room. Is it cool if I crash on your couch? Can you help me out with this? And I remember when I was a player, even with the Chargers, when I stayed at home the night before the game, or when I did something that was a little bit more comfortable than keeping it kind of the way that it was and consistent in terms of the preparation, my focus was off a little bit. And I never played as well when I slept at home, so I stopped doing it. We're creatures of habit. You mentioned that earlier, and that's why I think Cincinnati treating this as a true road game, understandably, and I think a little surprisingly, has an advantage because they're not playing at home.
Now, I know, Aaron, you're an advocate for mental health and the importance of it in sports, which has certainly gained a lot more traction even in the last calendar year. I mean, Simone Biles, one of the most recognized athletes in the world, was very upfront and honest about the battle she would often wage inside her head and actually had to pull out of some of her competition. We've seen some more of that here in these Winter Olympics that are taking place in China right now. Michaela Schifrin, one of the latest skier, has been dealing with some of that. And obviously there are probably examples, you know, in American sports as well. When you get to the ultimate game, one that you've been waiting for your entire career in football, how do you manage that when maybe there are some days where some of those demons kind of get the best of you and serve as another distraction?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think it's the heart of what the entire world is being asked to do 2 years post-COVID pandemic and the crap show that we've seen and all been through. Everybody has been affected from a mental health standpoint over these last 2 years worldwide. This is the single greatest period of instability that our generation has ever gone, and it's happening simultaneously around the globe. So it's not to be understated how significant it is, whether you've lost a job or had to shut down your business or, you know, being chippy with your wife, which is what happened to me, holding my son as he's cried himself to sleep because he can't go to practice and hang out with his buddies and he can't go to school. It's been a disaster for us. So Simone Biles, who is largely ridiculed for not being able to suck it up and compete, instead of realizing that she's been dealing with being sexually abused by convicted rapist Larry Nassar for 20 plus years, we should be celebrating the fact that these role models are finding ways to cope with the stresses of depression and anxiety in their life experience. And I think we need to celebrate that a little bit more and have some candid, honest conversations to shift it to include not just whether you're mentally ill or not, but where on the continuum do you fall? We're all dealing with something. We're all going through things. So an organization I've been working with, Same Here Global, you can go to the website, sameheareglobal.org, is a global alliance of athletes, entertainers, musicians, people that have come together to talk about what this animal is. It's called mental health, so that we can decrease the stigma and start to implement things to help us enjoy these incredible lives that we've been given.
Is there any way of quantifying or getting a handle on how this 2-year pandemic has affected, you know, people in unexpected ways, both kids going to school in masks or the vaccinated, non-vaccinated, travel, not travel, in person versus remote work? Every industry and every person has been affected by it in some way. Is there any way to get your arms around what that has meant to the collective consciousness of our country and the world at large?
It's a little early, but what the early data and indicators look to be is that we are in the very early innings of a mental health pandemic that I think history will look back on and very much is going to rival what we saw on the health side, the physical health side, from the virus itself. We are in the early innings, guys, of a tsunami that is coming, that is already starting to show up. And what the data shows with the year-over-year increases of self-mutilation and self-harm against young girls, what's taking place with boys on the educational system, basically a lost year of learning, a lost year of socialization. We have no idea how that's going to affect us, but I'll tell you this, it's affected me, and it was as simple as having 4 games in a row canceled where I'd done all the work, all the prep, and got there, and boom, it was like Lucy and Linus. I went to kick the ball, and it wasn't there. That constant letdown was really difficult for me to deal with. So what did I do? I came home, and I yelled at my wife and was chippy with my kids, and they got affected by it. Like, it was this 2-year period, man, of instability that has been a real challenge. So knowing that and being able to let go of some of all that stuff that we absorbed and had to find a way to compete through is going to be critical as we move forward. And sameheareglobal.org is a website where you can go, and it's a global alliance of people that share those tools so that we can start to begin this process of healing that really probably has a lot more way to go before it starts to get better.
On a much brighter note, Aaron, you are probably you might be one of the only guys with this current Pro Football Hall of Fame class that has a former college teammate and a former professional teammate in the same induction class. You've got Bryant Young, who was obviously your teammate at Notre Dame, the all-decade defensive tackle in the 90s with the 49ers, their all-time sack leader as well, along with Leroy Butler, the all-decade safety with the Packers. And you got to confirm this for me, because I saw this last night and I said, man, I didn't know that. Did he really, was he the first to do the Lambeau leap?
Yep. He is. He's not largely credited with it, but if you take a look at his Twitter handle, that'll tell you all you need to know about who wants to take responsibility for the Lambeau leap. Leroy was the consummate teammate, man. He is a brilliant addition to the elite of the elite of pro sports for the NFL Hall of Fame, and I was really happy to see him be in there. He was a hell of a player on the field, but he was also a great teammate. He was a Florida State guy that was kind of jovial, and like he was the levity for the defensive backfield, and we had some dudes on that defense. I got to watch him play every day. I got to watch Gilbert Brown play every day. I got to watch Reggie White play every day, and Leroy was as good as all of those guys and is a welcomed addition to the NFL. And what can you say about Bryant Young? Me, him, Jeff Burris were 3 of the 4 captains our senior year at Notre Dame. And I took my very first rep on campus at Notre Dame to do the leverage drill. No pads, just helmets. You fight for hand position and leverage. We still made it. We still made it for the next 4 years. But somewhere along the line, we both got drafted. He continued to get better, and I continued to get hurt. So I'm super happy for him. We just got back from Panama celebrating his 50th birthday with a fishing trip. But he wanted this for a long time, and he's as good as they get as a person, player, and teammate.
Well, Aaron, let's get to the game this weekend. What are your thoughts on both these clubs? We've talked a lot, and you said, you alluded to it, the star-studded roster, high-priced, star-studded free agents, high draft picks of the Los Angeles Rams, and then the Cincinnati Bengals, who for years have been, you know, this mom and pop organization. You know, like you got people in, you know, you got an LA Rams and a, some of these teams have 300 people in their building, and the Bengals got like 10 people working for it, right? So what are your thoughts on how this game and the philosophies of both clubs play out?
It's really interesting, Steve, because this game is emblematic of the cities that these franchises come from, right? The glitz and the glamour and all these stars. What should happen on Sunday is that the greatest strength of that team, of their defensive front seven and ability to rush the passer with Leonard Floyd, Von Miller, and Aaron Donald, should be able to take advantage of an interior offensive line in the right side that has struggled mightily, giving up the third most sacks in the NFL this season. But with all that said, and you guys know as well as anybody, this is a Cincinnati team that has somehow found a way to outpunch their weight class. They gave up 9 sacks in that game against Tennessee and found a way to win it. They went on the road to Kansas City and beat Patrick Mahomes, an elite quarterback, on his home track after being stifled in the first half on both sides of the football and completely flipped the script. There's something special about this team. Joe Burrow, I've always thought that the identity of a team is usually a reflection of its quarterback, and Burrow is as poised as they get. You listen to his post-game interviews, nothing was ever too big to him, and something tells me that Cincinnati's feeling the swag, then led by their white pimp Huggy Bear version of Joe Burrow and whatever outfits he's wearing in his post-game press conferences, that they've got some swag to them, and they absolutely feel like they're going to win this game, and I think they somehow find a way to do it in a high-scoring affair.
Yeah, I mean, because I was looking through some of the numbers, and I mean, you can dice up dozens and dozens of statistics leading up to this game. These two teams tied for 7th in the league in scoring. They both averaged 28 yep. points per game, and I know Cincinnati scoring is slightly down in the postseason from that number. I think the Rams are right at 27 points a game here in the postseason. But I agree with you. I think it's whose defense really shows up here in this one, because I think those two offenses in many ways cancel each other out with the playmaking ability of their receiving cores, you know, and the cool, calm nature of both quarterbacks for the most part. What is it about Cincinnati's defense that might enable them to measure up and have a better day than that star-studded defensive front that you just mentioned?
Well, they got a nickel guy, Mike Hilton, that can move around and give you a lot of versatility on what you're going to do. We know the shifts, trades, and motions that the Rams try to do to create those one-on-one matchups. We know who Cooper Kupp is. We know the playmaking ability of OBJ. Pass rush nullifies all of that. Tampa taught us that against Kansas City last year, where they basically neutered a Patrick Mahomes that had an MVP caliber season. So the same thing could happen to Cincinnati, but you take a look at what the Bengals have been able to do. They rush the passer, I think, a little bit better than people think. We saw the play that they made against Kansas City on the road right before halftime. Now that ball probably should have been thrown, or should have been thrown a little bit more accurately to Tyreek Hill to give him a chance to score. But that was the play that shifted that game for them. And that's really been emblematic of who they've been. You identified it, Chris. I think the matchups and what the defenses do to be able to nullify or create the matchups that are favorable for them is a really key storyline. And that's going to be nuanced. And it's not going to be as obvious as it's going to be at times. But you take Jalen Ramsey for the Rams and the way they like to move him around at times, playing him over the slot as a nickel, having him in the box as a jack linebacker to rush the passer or to be a big box run-stuffing safety. They try to utilize him and put him in positions of strength proactively. But at times, they've gotten too cute, and they've given up big plays. We saw that against Devontae Adams in the against Green Bay when he pointed to his hat saying, come on, guys, you can't have those mental busts and let the best player on the field run free. So with 2 weeks to prepare, you can add some wrinkles, but it's imperative that you don't get too cute. Because in games like this, you don't necessarily need to make the great play. You must eliminate the bad one. And the team that can play the cleanest from a penalty and turnover standpoint is probably going to win this deal.
Interestingly enough, Zach Taylor was on the staff that went to the Super Bowl with the Rams back in 2018, I guess. Which of these young coaches gets the most out of that experience? And which of them coming in do you think is like has maybe – outcoach the other, or you know, may be the guy who makes the decision or makes the play or makes the coaching move that wins it for his team. Which one of you guys, which guy do you give the advantage to in this matchup?
Well, it's interesting, man. They're both aggressive play callers. My gut wants to say Zach Taylor because he doesn't have the pressure of getting back there and having to win this time. That is a real deal and a real burden that Sean McVay is going to have to carry. You also have an offensive coordinator in Kevin O'Connell, who's the head coach of another team. You know for a fact he's had to do some things to be able to get his staffs together that have taken him away from the preparation from this game. Nobody is expecting Cincinnati to win. And you can't play the game of football scared. You can't play it slow. And I think because of that, they're going to let it ride, man. They're going to play loose. They're going to let it hang. And they're going to be uber aggressive. And if you want to be the king, you got to take it. And I think Cincinnati is built and their staff is more apt to make aggressive play calls to get it done because they really feel like there's nothing to lose versus the Rams, who have put all their chips in the middle of the table and the have to's start to play a role. And that's when I think teams can have a tendency to get tight. I got to tell you, man, the more we get to this game, the more I can make a case for Cincinnati being the favorable team.
Yeah. Right. Aaron, we appreciate the insight on that. Last two things I have for you. First, what were you guys fishing for when you were on the fishing trip with Bryant Young? And second, has anyone ever told you that you could be a dead ringer voice-wise for James Earl Jones?
I love it. Can I be in Star Wars too, or
yeah,
CNN and get the money that James Earl Jones got?
I kind of want you to say, "This is CNN." And there's part of me that
this is CNN.
Doesn't he sound like him?
He sounds just like him.
All right, now
I'm
telling you, man, you might have some secondary work on hand. You got to call your agent. But what were you guys fishing for? What'd you say you were down in Mexico or?
Down in Panama, man, Central America. It was my first time down there. I'm a big angler, offshore guy, and we had been down there together about 11 years ago to catch sailfish in Costa Rica and crushed it. So we were down there targeting billfish, sailfish, and marlin and tuna, kind of halfway in between the seasons. So we had good but not great fishing, but I tweeted out a picture where BY caught a really nice sailfish on our first day, and then we hammered some reef donkeys, these big Cubrera snapper. We kept these big amberjacks that just want to double your pole over. So it was constant action on big fish. We caught four sharks, all above 200 pounds, and were able to release them at the boat. And those were 45-minute fights where it was like, you better pack a lunch because they were. So really good time down there. Great people, great country, super safe. The fruit and food was out of this world. So a great way to celebrate Bryant's 50th birthday. And my God, has he had a hell of a month.
Yeah, no doubt. Steve's got a question for you about Andre.
I know that at one point in your life, you lived, I guess, next door to Andre Reed, who's a real close friend of mine. And also, tell me a little bit, if you have a story about Don Beebe and his trips to the Super Bowl and some of the things that he went through. As after going 0-4 with us, he at least went 1-1 with you guys.
Yeah, that was a big deal for Don too, man. As I mentioned early on in this interview, Holmgren had him and McMahon get up and kind of walk us through. And it basically was the best practices of all the things they learned not to do, unfortunately, in those four games. It didn't go the way that you guys wanted it. So for him to be able to get a ring and finally get over that hump, I know how important that has been to him. And I've talked to him at our reunions and all the times we come back as a team to celebrate that. It really is the crown jewel of professional sports. You enter it, the elite of the elite of the elite. And I know that things didn't want to go the way that he wanted there in Buffalo. In his heart of heart, he's always going to be a Buffalo Bill, but he did get a little bit of the stank out of his mouth by having the ring with us. And Dre was as good of a neighbor as it gets. It's still one of my favorite houses in San Diego. We still live right next to the house that he was in, and adjacent to me, like sharing a fence, Dennis Green, the former late head coach, lived right next door.
That's so his college coach. That's Steve's college coach.
That's right.
So there was this whole small world. I would affectionately call it Little Canton and try to ride those guys' coattails. But It was awesome. Dre would come over and grab the proverbial this or that and a cup of sugar and some activator gel for that crazy hair he's got. And it was good having him as a neighbor for as long as we did.
That's good stuff. That's awesome. Good people. Yeah, Dennis Green, I had nothing but love and respect for that guy. Loved him to death. He really helped me in my career early on at Northwestern, and I knew it. We thought even then, I thought he was going to be a better pro coach than he was here at Northwestern. He's fit for, and he really showed that in his career with the Vikings and the Arizona Cardinals.
Yeah, he's a great man. I got to know him and his wife and their kids pretty well over the years, and we still stay in contact with them. The game of football on this planet lost a great man when Dennis passed away.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Aaron. Really appreciate you, man. Thanks for coming on and sharing some stories with us.
My pleasure, boys. Always happy to come on, talk some ball, have some laughs, and go Bills.
Yeah, right, man. Thank you much, Aaron. That's Aaron Taylor, former Packers offensive lineman, former first-round pick of the Packers, Super Bowl champion in Super Bowl 31.
How about Aaron ending with a Go Bills for us? That
CBS
was nice.
Sports draft analyst and NFL analyst for CBS Sports on the website. So, yeah, I'm telling you, man, he sounds just like – he's talking to us, and I'm like, you know, why do I feel like I'm listening to James Earl Jones?
And it does, yeah,
he's got to get on the horn with his agent.
Right, it doesn't even have to be like – it doesn't even have to be like a – standing for his voice alone on its own would be
well,
good.
Yes, it's very commanding. It sounds like it's coming from the depths of his body.
It sounds like it's coming from a giant.
Those are some
pipes,
man.
He's a big dude, but yeah.
I mean, you know. I mean, you've been in broadcasting long enough. When you hear good pipes, those are some pipes right there, man.
And they rarely ever leave you, too, either. That's,
man, really good voice.
Good for him.
All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to get some of your questions that are from the Friday OBL fan mailbag, and we'll also run quickly through the 2022 Pro Football Hall of Fame induction class that was introduced last night at the NFL Honors. That's all coming up next here on One Bills Live, presented by Kaleida Health. It's Buffalo Bills Radio. All right, welcome back to One Bills Live. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you. We will get to the Pro Football Hall of Fame class and your questions on the OBL Fan Friday mailbag, but it slipped my mind. I am still a little bit out of practice on Fridays at 2:30, but it is time for the latest installment, Steve, of Tasker's Teammate.
Oh, out of the blue!
Brought to you by Wegmans Meals to Go. Delicious meals delivered. Download the Wegmans app today. Are you ready for clue number one, Steve?
I guess so.
You don't have a choice. Born in Columbus, Georgia, I was a very successful multi-sport athlete in high school, but I was lightly recruited as I was only 170 pounds. I eventually accepted a scholarship to Wisconsin, where I not only played football, but also ran track. Kind of a similar path for you.
Yeah. What did you say? How much did he weigh?
170.
Columbus, Georgia?
That's right.
Nate Odoms.
Dang it. I don't like it when you get it on the first.
I got
move.
It?
Yeah, Nate Odoms.
Boom!
That's right.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah!
I don't like it when you get it on the first clue. You ruin all the fun.
Play the fight song.
What, the Wisconsin fight song?
Know. Some fight. I need a fight
Wisconsin.
Song. We need a One Bills Live fight song. That's what we need. Submission.
When you get it right.
Put your submissions in for the Tasker's Teammate fight song.
I was wondering if I had given you
too
much.
We'd only play it if I do get it on one or two guests.
So you knew Nate was from Georgia.
I knew. I was a total shot in the dark. But I knew it was a smaller guy. I knew the guy had to be fast. And, you know, it narrows down the field. So it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be Ted Washington. Right. So
he was an All-American in track. And then all Big Ten in football. He was only a 2-year starter for the Badgers.
And I got to tell you, I'd forgotten he even went to Wisconsin.
Yeah. 2-year starter for the Badgers, 9 interceptions, including 7 his senior year. That's what put him on the map in the draft. Ended up being high second round pick of the Bills.
There has been a lot of great defensive backs come out of Wisconsin, and now they've got running backs lined up there as well.
Troy Vincent.
Yeah, there's been a ton of them. Yeah.
Even Jimmy Leonard. Who was an undrafted guy, had a 10-year career in the league.
Yeah.
Really smart player. Now he's their defensive coordinator.
The first pick
up there.
A first-round draft pick. My rookie season for the Houston Oilers was also a defensive back out of Wisconsin.
And you're not going to remember his name?
Johnson was his last name.
Johnson was his last name. Yeah. Okay.
And he was he's a really good player. Played for a long time. Chris Johnson? No. Chris
Johnson? I couldn't tell you.
Anyway.
So second round pick of the Bills in 87. One of those 22 players to be on the roster for all four Super Bowl teams. Led the league in interceptions in 1993 with 9. And you tell me, Steve, which of his interceptions were bigger? I'm going to give you his two most noteworthy.
Richard Johnson.
Richard Johnson, okay.
Okay.
I'm going to give you two of his most noteworthy interceptions. You tell me which you felt was bigger. I think I know the answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. He had an interception at Super Bowl 28 off Troy Aikman in the first half. Helped you guys go into the locker room up 13-6 at halftime.
Right.
He also had an interception off Warren Moon in overtime in the comeback game that led to the game-winning field goal.
Right.
That's probably number one, right?
Yeah, there was another one, too, in the 1990 game early in the season where we beat the Raiders on Sunday Night Football. I had the block punt for a touchdown, J.D. Williams, late in the game. And this really put a big stamp on the team that we were playing for. Willie Gault runs an out route. Nate's on him. He catches it. Nate just bullies the ball away from him, pushes him out of bounds, and runs back for a pick six.
Oh, he rips the ball out of his hands.
Rips the ball out of his hands and just takes off. Just bullied him. And that was a statement about the mindset of that defense, the toughness of the defense. You know, just we were getting pushed around. We were actually going to win the game. And then, you know, they were coming back. Jay Schrader tries to hit Willie. And Nate just literally just rips the ball out of his hands. He already caught it. Mm. And there was it was no replay back then. And you might have thought Willie might have been out of bounds, but by the time his back foot slid out of bounds, when he turned to try and hang on to the ball, Nate already had it, was going the other way. Yeah, Nate had a tremendous career here. Tremendous.
Seven seasons as Tasker's teammate. Signed as a free agent with Seattle, but it didn't go well there. He injured his knee.
He got
never
a knee
played
injury.
A game for the Seahawks.
He was playing off-season basketball and blew his ACL.
Oh, never played a game for the Seahawks, finished up his career with his hometown team, the Atlanta Falcons, in 96, but appeared in only 4 games for the Falcons, his final season in the league. So all 26 of his career interceptions in a Bills uniform. Nice career for him.
Yeah, very much.
Especially for a 170-pound high school grad. Not a bad career to carve out for yourself. So he is the latest Tasker's teammate.
Yeah.
We were unable to get a hold of Nate. We were trying, and he just wasn't available at this time. Not that he was unwilling to come on. He just wasn't able to fit it into his schedule. We kind of got a hold of him late.
Far be it from us to plan this ahead, right? I didn't know we were
We tried. We tried. So that's that.
I don't want to go off on a tangent. You know, that 85 draft I was in with the Houston Oilers where – Richard Johnson, another defensive back out of Wisconsin and all that. You know who else was in my draft class? Was Ray Childress, was the top player pick, number 3 overall.
Pretty good offensive lineman.
Frank Bush.
This is your Houston Oilers draft class you're giving me here.
Frank Bush, who is now was a defensive coordinator for a minute for a couple of teams, been a coach for a long time. Lee Johnson, the punter, who punted for Cincinnati when they went to the Super Bowl in 88. And then the guy drafted right after me was Mike Golic Sr.
That's right. We had Mike on ESPN. Recently, and ESPN. You guys were commiserating about that draft class.
12 draft picks that year. There were 11 or 12 rounds. They had 2 first rounders. A lot of nostalgia going back that far.
That's right. All right, so the 2022 Pro Football Hall of Fame class was announced at the NFL Honors last night. Tony Boselli, first draft pick in Jaguars history, a star in college at USC, was the second overall pick in the 95 draft, and he was part of the 1990s all-decade team, led the Jags to their rise to playoff prominence under Tom Coughlin in the mid to late 90s, but shoulder injuries shortened his career. Leroy Butler, who we already mentioned, Steve, a guy you played against.
Right.
And I want to say, I don't know if I'm going to have this right, your last game when Lonnie Johnson got lit up because he forgot about the return man, was that Leroy Butler or Darren Sharper?
I think it was Sharper, but I'm not sure. I don't know. I can't remember.
Because I could see Butler putting a lick on somebody. Ooh, I wouldn't be surprised if it was him. All-decade safety and claims to be the first to do the Lambeau leap. Mm-hmm. Sam Mills, member of the Dome Patrol in New Orleans. Remember that defense with Ricky Jackson?
And also a great one with the Carolina Panthers in the expansion draft. Yeah. He got picked up and played very well for the Panthers.
Now, I was not aware of this, but Mills toiled in the other leagues of football before he got to the NFL. He was an undrafted linebacker out of Montclair State, joined the Toronto Argonauts out of college after he got cut by Cleveland, played for the USFL's, I believe it was the Philadelphia Stars at that point, because didn't they also play in Baltimore? Baltimore, and then they moved to Philadelphia, I believe. Then he was released from Toronto before he made it on an NFL roster in 1986.
He was
went to five Pro Bowls.
He's 5 feet, 9 inches, yeah. 225.
But he's built like a refrigerator
box. Oh, yeah,
he's
thick, but 5'9", and that his nickname was the Field Mouse because that's what, you know, ostensibly one of the coaches, he looks like a field mouse out there. We got a field mouse at middle linebacker. Anyway, the guy ends up going to the Hall of Fame. So
we already heard
congratulations to him.
From Aaron Taylor about his former college teammate Bryant Young, the 49ers all-time
Bryant
sack
Young
leader.
Could play, man. That I played
14
the Pro Bowl
years,
with him, yeah.
208 consecutive starts at defensive tackle,
yeah.
Steve. That's hard to do.
Yeah,
he's
go.
A freak.
Yeah.
Another freak, Richard Seymour.
Richard Seymour was a massive man, 6'6", athlete.
Yeah. And younger NFL fans don't know this, but the Patriots dynasty that we hear about that ran for 20 years, the infancy of that dynasty was dominated by its defense. Tom Brady wasn't winning Super Bowls throwing the ball all over the yard and 5 touchdowns a game. They were winning games 16-13 and 20-16, right. And it was their defense that was the catalyst of those first 3 Super Bowls that they won, 3 in 4 years, no less. And he was a central figure.
Teddy Bruschi was in that group.
He was a central figure on that defense for sure. Ty Law, Lawyer Malloy, that whole crew. Cliff Branch, Raiders wide receiver. I gravitated to a lot of the receivers as a kid watching football as a young guy, and I loved watching Cliff Branch. First of all, I thought it was cool that a guy with number 21 was playing wide receiver. That attracted me, number one. And then number two, he was like greased lightning out there.
He was really fast. Really fast.
Part of all 3 Raiders Super Bowl winning teams in 76, 80, and 83, and a 3-time first-team All-Pro, which is hard to do at receiver. Dick Vermeil, one of only 7 coaches to lead 2 franchises to the Super Bowl. Obviously, the Super Bowl win with the Rams, lost it with the Eagles. And an official is in for the first time, known as the father of modern officiating. Art McNally served as the NFL's supervisor of officials for 24 years, 1968 to 1991.
A long and illustrious career for Art McNally. I remember you kind of recognize his face when you see the pictures. You remember him as an official. And for me, in my broadcast career, the guy was in the booth. You know, he was like he was around the league all the time for years and years and years. So he, congratulations to him and his family, the rest of those guys as well. Tremendous class, good for them. And you just like to see it. The league just gets it right when they pick those guys.
We will take a break here. Steve and I will close it up with a couple of OBL Fan Friday mailbag questions. Back in a moment here on One Bills Live. OBL Friday fan mailbag we go. Christopher asks, I've been waiting to ask Steve this for a while. The game where you slid under Deion Sanders and grabbed his foot, was that scouting or was that spur-of-the-moment circumstances? Just wondering because nobody could drop him for no or minimal game.
That was spur-of-the-moment.
Yeah,
you can't plan that. I ran down as fast as I could. The guy was going to block me. I went down and slid under his block because I knew I thought I might be able to get there and cut Deion off before he got going. He jumped over me, and I thought I'd missed him, and I pinned it. I got his ankle. I got his heel with my wrist, and his toes were caught under my armpit, and I pulled him down. And that was opening kickoff of the game. I would say this, too. I bet you he never got tackled on a shorter kickoff return than that one.
Yeah.
He might have knelt down or run out of bounds, but I got him on that one.
Yeah, you did.
That's one.
Super Bowl.
That's one.
Super Bowl 56 in L.A., Steve, is going projected to be the most heavily bet on game ever.
Oh, yeah.
They are estimating 7.61 billion with a B to be wagered on Sunday. I saw a headline. There was a $5 million bet on the outcome yesterday. It's a 78% increase from last year. That's according to the American Gaming Association.
All I know
good
is
luck if you got a bet out there, people.
None of it's yours or mine.
Yeah, amen to that. Maddie and I doing the show on Monday. We'll see you then.